In a vision, Jesus told Ananias that Paul was going to bear witness to Christ before kings.
And yet as we followed Paul through all of his missionary journeys, indeed we've seen him testifying to Christ to the Gentiles, to the Jews, in the synagogue, to lesser magistrates, but nowhere before kings.
But if we know anything about God, we know He is trustworthy. And as we continue Dr. R.C. Sproul's expository series in the book of Acts today, we will see Christ's words become reality. Thanks for listening to Renewing Your Mind on this Lord's Day. We have been following Paul through some violent and difficult circumstances. When he returned to Jerusalem, a mob was stirred up by his preaching. In order to save his life, the Romans took him into custody where they tried to figure out why the crowd was so angry. That's where Dr. Sproul picks up the story today.
If you remember back in chapter 9 of the book of Acts, where we had the first record of Paul's conversion on the desert road to Damascus, how he was blinded by that great light and was led by the hand groping in the darkness into Damascus, and that Jesus had told him in the midst of that conversion to present himself to a man by the name of Ananias who dwelt in Damascus. And as they were leading Paul into the city, then Christ appeared to Ananias, and he said, "I'm sending Paul, Saul of Tarsus, to you," and he gave them instructions. And you remember, Ananias was a little bit upset about that. "You're sending who? Saul of Tarsus, we know who he is. He's public enemy number one. He's the one that's dragging everybody out of their homes and throwing him in the prison. You want me to minister to him?" And Jesus had to rebuke Ananias, remember? And he said to him, "Listen, I've anointed him. I have chosen him to be the apostle, my apostle, to the Gentiles, and to bear witness to me, to the Gentiles," and then he said, "and to kings." Remember that? And yet as we followed Paul through all of his missionary journeys, indeed we've seen him testifying to Christ to the Gentiles, to the Jews, in the synagogue, to lesser magistrates, but nowhere before kings or the upper echelon of government. But even though Paul's freedom is over, his ministry isn't. And as he is languishing now in the prison, there at the barracks by the Antonian fortress, if he's human at all, he's got to be wondering about whether his ministry is over, whether there's going to be any fruit at all for the labor that he's offered for Christ in all of these travails of the past. Do you ever feel like that? I think of Calvin when he was banished from Geneva and sent off to Strasbourg, where he ministered to a congregation of 300. He called it his little church in Strasbourg. And as he was preaching and teaching there, who would have imagined that 500 years later, people would still be translating those sermons and those messages and those lectures to feed the whole church of the 21st century? Or Jonathan Edwards, who after many years of faithful service to that congregation in Northampton was fired on the basis of false reports and slander and exiled from the town. And he went to work among the Indians. And there, while he was at Stockbridge, he took that occasion to sit down and write The Freedom of the Will, one of the 10 most important classics of all of Christian history. Who knows when God is finished with you? Who knows how much impact your life and your testimony will have. Just a few weeks ago, we had Sinclair Ferguson here on the day of the celebration of our mission conference. And you remember when he told a little bit about his conversion, how he was led to Christ by a man who in turn was converted by the witness of a woman who was a typist. And he kept listening to this clickety-clack, clickety-clack, clickety-clack of this typewriter and said, why is it that that typist seems to be so much more consistent than everyone else? And found out that she was a Christian who dedicated her typing to the kingdom of God and to the glory of Christ. What would that woman think if she realized that as a result of her typing, another man was led to Christ, who in turn led Sinclair Ferguson to Christ, who has taught the whole world of the gospel, just because this woman was faithful at a typewriter. But we're human, and we struggle, and we wonder whether it's worth it. At the first service, Debbie Wilson was here, and before the service started, she gave me a far better sermon than you will hear from me this day. I told her how happy I was to see her back from her bed of pain, and she was just radiant. And she said, oh, R.C., she said, yeah, the pain was terrible. I don't want to wish shingles on anybody. She said, but there was a time in that, she said, where it was affecting my head and in my eyes, and I felt like Samson. I said, Samson? How could you feel like Samson? You feeling strong? What do you mean? She said, well, don't you remember, Pastor, that Samson had his eyes gouged out, and his mission wasn't over yet. And I thought, how wonderful that somebody in our midst uses a biblical narrative from the Old Testament to help herself understand the affliction that she's going through now. And she said, and so I said to the Lord, Lord, what do you want me to learn from this? And she said, I think that what the Lord was trying to show me was that I need to have more sensitivity and more compassion with other people who are in pain. And that I hope God will use my pain to make me more faithful in intercession. What could I tell you this morning that's more important than that? And that's the way Paul was. Despite his being discouraged, despite his wondering about this thing, he still had work to do. And in the midst of that barracks there, Jesus appears to him again. And listen to what he says to him. He says, Paul, be of good cheer. For as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness in Rome. Again, remember the Great Commission at the day of Jesus' ascension into heaven. When he left his disciples, he said, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the uttermost parts of the earth. And that commission was then given to Paul. And now Jesus said, Paul, you did it for me in Jerusalem. And I know you've wanted to go to Rome. Now you're going to get to go to Rome. Didn't expect to go in chains, but you're going to go to Rome to carry on your ministry before those who are in that city. And he says to Paul, be of good cheer. That's, I think, this is one of those times when I think sometimes the English just doesn't get it. It doesn't really grasp the force of it. First of all, it says that Jesus stood by him. That's weak. The words there in the Greek is that Jesus came, in a sense, overshadowing Paul. His presence is enormous. There's Paul cringing in his cell, and suddenly the risen Christ comes hovering over him, and he says, Paul. The Latin here that is translates it uses the word that is the foundation for the English word constancy. It's not like the good humor man saying, cheer up. He's saying, Paul, hey, be constant. Not just infrequent. Be consistent. Stay with the ministry that you've had through all these years. Day in, day out. Stay constant. Do we need to hear that? I need to hear it. But this is how Jesus encouraged his apostle, who, if anybody had ever been constant in ministry from the day he was called, it was Paul. And yet Jesus had to come to him personally, shore him up, stay the course, finish the race, be constant. And we read the very next day, some of the Jews bound themselves together, Luke tells us this three times, that they were so convinced that Paul had to die, that these 40-plus men gathered together and took a sacred vow to go on a hunger strike. They would eat no food, drink nothing until Paul was dead. They were zealots. And if we know anything about these people, they were the terrorists of the first century. They were infuriated by Roman occupation. They hated the Sanhedrin. They hated the scribes and the Pharisees because they were convinced that the Jewish authorities had sold them out. But they would use the authorities whenever it was expedient for their goals. And their goal in this case was to kill Paul. Now you see it today. Every day you read in the paper, see it on TV, about people who tie explosives to their own body and run in and become human suicide bombs. The kamikaze pilots of World War II. That's what these people were like. One, perhaps two of the 12 had been numbered among this group of assassins and terrorists. Simon Zelotes, who was a zealot. And there's good reason to believe that the meaning of the name Judas Iscariot is not just Judas from a place called Iscariot, but is Judas from the Zechariah, the assassins. One of these zealots, it makes sense that Judas joined the band of disciples of Jesus with the hope of throwing over the Romans. And when he saw Jesus didn't come with a sword, he said, I'll trade that in for some money and find another Messiah. These people meant business. And now their zeal was a zeal without knowledge. Their zeal was to kill the anointed one of God. And so they set the trap. They told the Sanhedrin, call him down, tell the commander you want him to come back again and speak once more for further interrogation. And when they begin to transfer him here, we'll be waiting. We'll set the ambush. And when they bring Paul, we'll fall upon him and kill him. We know that to take on the Romans in that situation will mean heavy casualties for us. But we're committed to wipe out the influence of Christianity and this apostle. And so they banded together and called on the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin agrees to this chicanery. And then notice how Paul escapes this one. Verse 16, when Paul's sister's son, this is the first time we ever heard anything about Paul's family, that whether he had any brothers or sisters. Obviously, he had at least one sister, and that sister had a son, and this is a nephew, and we don't know how in the world Paul's nephew heard about this plot to kill Uncle Paul. You wonder whether when Paul joined the Christian faith, whether his family remained Jewish and had a burial service for him. But obviously his sister remained loyal to him, and his sister's son, his nephew, the family stayed together. I have a friend who's a minister, and he said, their family motto is, we stick with the stuck. I said, what's that? He says, I don't know, but my dad always said, we stick with the stuck. That means we hang together as a family. That's where our courage should come, shouldn't it? In my house, every day, every single day, when my grandson Michael comes home from school, before he says hello, before he does anything, he holds his hand like this, straight up. Right, Mike? Straight up. And he's been wanting me to do that for him from the pulpit for months. So I'm loyal to my grandson. I appreciate his encouragement. And this is the only time you ever hear of this kid. He goes to heaven. God says, what did you do? And he says to God, didn't you read the 23rd chapter of Acts? He says, I saved the life of my uncle Paul. I went to Paul and I told him when he was in his cell that there was this plot to kill him. And so Paul told me to go and tell the commander, and I did. And so his life was spared. The commander said, wait a minute, we can't have this. So he commanded 470 troops as an armed guard to whisk Paul out of Jerusalem and take him 60 miles north to Caesarea, where there was a headquarters of the regional governor there, whose name was Felix. Have you ever gone anywhere under an armed guard? I've had that experience twice in my life. The first time was in high school, after we won a game at a Catholic high school in basketball in double overtime. And when we were on the way back to the locker room, the kids just emptied the stands, fell upon us while we were still on the court, and started pummeling us and beating us. And I was never so happy to see a Roman Catholic priest in my whole life as this priest stood between me and the mob and got me carefully into the locker room, whereupon they called the police, and we had a police escort to leave that place. It had nothing to do with bearing witness to Christ. Then once in California, I had somebody give a death threat, so they had armed guards for me there. But that's nothing. Jim Dobson has bulletproof glass on his office windows and a bulletproof place in the garage for his parking lot and on his car, because every day he's subjected to death threats because of the stands he's taken against abortion and other destructive moves of the family in our country. But we're very fortunate that we don't need an armed guard to escape with our lives from day to day. But Paul did. And the commander said, give me 470 soldiers, give me some horses or something for Paul, put him on that, and at 9 o'clock tonight, we're out of here under the cover of darkness, and before these zealots can find out about it, we'll have Paul safely in Caesarea. And so the soldiers did as they were commanded. They traveled 35 miles with the whole entourage, and then when they saw they were safe, the infantry went back and the cavalry took Paul the rest of the way to Caesarea. But notice this letter that is contained in the text that Luke gives. When he writes to Felix, the governor, he says this, Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor, Felix. Let's note that. In the Roman society, there was clearly defined levels of social order and stratification. Obviously, at the apex of the social order was the emperor himself. But on really the first tier of societal honor were those who were the members of the Senate. And then in the second tier, the next highest tier of honor in the society of Rome, were the equestrian knights, like the knights of the Round Table. And those equestrian knights, they were given the title Most Excellent. The equestrian order, second only to the Senate, and regional governors, those two groups, were given the honorific title Most Excellent. And so when Claudius Lysias sends Paul to Felix, he's sending him to somebody who's very high up in the Roman hierarchy of things. Now notice the content of the letter. Greetings. This man was seized by Jews, that's true, was about to be killed by them, that's true. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. A little bit self-serving there, isn't it, Claudius? And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council, found out he was accused and all of that. but at nothing was charged against him, deserving of death or chains. You notice he doesn't say, before I found out he was a Roman, I put him in chains and I was ready to flog him. Well, none of that's in the letter. But when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. And then we're told how Paul was then delivered to Felix. Again, who is Felix? He's the governor situated in Caesarea, a representative of the Emperor Claudius of Rome. He has great credentials in terms of history. Recently, I mentioned a woman who was on television who said, I don't even know whether Jesus ever existed because there's no mention of Jesus in any historical record apart from the Bible, as if the Bible were not an important historical record. And of course, she was wrong about that because there are references in Suetonius and in Tacitus, however brief they are, to Christ. But in the meantime, we look at the great historians of the Roman era, and the four most important historians of antiquity, Suetonius, Tacitus, Josephus, and far away, the best historian of them all is Luke, the physician. Believe it or not, all four of those historians write about this man named Felix. We're told that Felix was born into slavery, but later on was given his freedom, either by the mother of Claudius, according to Tacitus, or by Claudius himself, according to Josephus. So there's that disagreement between those two. But in any case, they agreed he was born a slave and then elevated to the level of governor. His brother, Pallas, was also born in slavery. He rose so high in the Roman hierarchy that he became in charge of all of the civil servants in Rome. It would be like a cabinet position in the United States government with the president. So these two fellows are very high up in the Roman hierarchy. We know this also about Felix. He had three wives. His first wife, get this, was the granddaughter of Antony and Cleopatra. That's the plot. Thicken? Or what? Mark Antony, Cleopatra had children, and the grandchild is the wife of this fellow Felix. His third wife was Drusilla, who was the daughter of King Herod Agrippa I. So Felix, though he began as a slave, is now married to royalty, surrounded by royalty, having the honorific titles of royalty. And we're told by Tacitus, however, that he was known for his brutal and ruthless quelling of insurrections in his territory when the Jews would stand up against the Romans. Felix would wipe them out. So the Tacitus said he had the power of a king, but the mind of a slave. And yet, he goes down in history. And the most important thing that will ever occur to him in his life is his encounter with Paul the Apostle, whom, in the providence of God and by his grace, we'll be able to examine next week.
Understanding the historical context helps us understand what we will be learning in the coming weeks, and we do hope you'll join us for those sermons by Dr. Sproul. We welcome you to the Sunday edition of Renewing Your Mind, and we're sharing this series through the book of Acts each week here on the Lord's Day, and each week we're encouraged by Paul's persistence in preaching the gospel. Throughout his life, Dr. Sproul worked to share the good news as well, and that's why he wrote the booklet, What Does It Mean to Be Born Again? For your gift of any amount, we'd like to send you two copies of this booklet. You can make your request when you call us at 800-435-4343 or when you go online to renewingyourmind.org. Each of us are called to go and make disciples. Giving this booklet to a family member or a friend is a good place to begin. Perhaps you could agree to read it together and discuss what you find. Again, for your gift of any amount, we will send you two copies of this booklet. It's titled, What Does It Mean to Be Born Again? Our number again is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. Before we go today, let me say that it is not our goal here at Ligonier Ministries to replace the local church. Even as we share the preaching ministry of Dr. Sproul on Sunday, our hope, indeed our prayer, is that you remain committed to meeting together with your local body of believers and sitting under your church leadership. We're thankful that we can make this radio program available to you for further study. God bless you on this Lord's Day. Well, R.C. helped us understand Paul's predicament as he awaits a trial before Felix. And when that trial finally begins, guess what Paul does? If your answer is preach the gospel, you're absolutely right. We hope you'll join us next Sunday for Renewing Your Mind.